Okay, so the topic for today is avatars, virtual spirituality, and I'm going to be talking through quite a lot of ideas, so bear with me. But just for entertainment's sake, I'm going to play you a little pseudo-documentary on Avatar, which is, I think, voiced over by Sigourney Weaver. So here we go, just to remind you of the space we're going to be looking at.
Pandora, a world of wonder and mystery, incredible danger and strange beauty. From Earth's southern hemisphere, you can see the solar system where Pandora is located. Alpha Centauri. At a distance of 4.4 light years from Earth, the Alpha Centauri system is our nearest stellar neighbor, the largest of its two sun-like stars. Alpha Centauri A, or ACA to astronomers, is Pandora's sun. Pandora is one of many moons orbiting the planet Polyphemus, a gas giant planet the size of Saturn. Pandora's toxic atmosphere makes it uninhabitable by humans. Tropical rainforest covers a large part of each of the continents. These rainforests are similar to those that once covered the Amazon basin, but on a scale several times the size of anything on Earth. A wide variety of animals can be found throughout Pandora, awe-inspiring and dangerous. Most animals, including the winged creatures of the sky, are hexapods, six-limbed, except the humanoid Na'vi, standing 9 to 10 feet tall. The dire horse is a six-legged behemoth, used by the Na'vi for hunting and trekking. The Na'vi also use the banshee to hunt from the air, but hunter can become prey in the presence of the even larger Great Leonopteryx. In the canopy below, other vicious predators roam. Packs of viper wolves, thick-skinned hammerhead Titanotheres, and the most fearsome land predator, the Thanator. But there is beauty even in the most frightening things. In a dreamlike landscape reminiscent of a Magritte painting, vast magnetic fields, coupled with the exotic properties of unobtainium, allow the Hallelujah Mountains to float in flux, constantly moving. As the most efficient superconductor known to exist, unobtainium is a rare earth mineral mined by humans and the sole reason for their presence on Pandora. Every living organism on Pandora has bioluminescent qualities that set the night aglow. Plants, animals, and marine organisms share this same trait, emitting light in breathtaking patterns. From what scientists can tell, the Pandoran ecology works and communicates like a nervous system, suggesting a symbiotic relationship between all things Pandoran. Perhaps the best symbols of this relationship are small luminescent wood sprites, which are the seeds of the Vitraya Ramunam, the tree of souls. The tree is sacred to the Na'vi and believed to be the heart of the deep connection of all life. Pandora. One can only think of its namesake in Greek mythology. The box has been opened. Amidst the savage terrain and fierce creatures, we must assume this strange, bewitching place might hold something inside itself for us all. Hope. For our race, for our planet, and for the future of all living things.
Okay, so basic storyline, and for those of you who haven't seen Avatar, I'm not going to ruin it for you. No, I am. I want to do that. But one of the things, we begin by following this guy, who's Jake Sully. He's a paraplegic, which is good, because if you want to make your hero more appealing to the audience, you have to make him an underdog. It's just one of the rules of storytelling. So he has to drive this remotely controlled body called an avatar. And here is Jake trying out his new avatar body. And the aim of this is to help him and a few of the other people involved to go into the Na'vi tribes, these blue people, blue monkey people or blue cat people, depending on what you prefer to call them, and to make connection with them, to get to know their culture, that kind of thing. And so one day he goes out with these scientists and gets lost, because this thing, which is a hammer-headed titanothea, this is what happens when a dinosaur and a hammerhead shark mate. He runs into this, and then into an even worse baddie, which is this Thanator. These are really great names. And the Thanator chases him away, and he gets separated. Jake gets separated from his group and gets lost in the forest. And because the group sends out a search party and tries to look for him, but to no avail, he has to spend the night there. At one point, he then gets attacked by some wolves, which happens all the time. We all know this. And is rescued by Neytiri, who is the main female protagonist and love interest. And thanks to the noise outside. And through a series of events, Jake then gets initiated into the Omatikaya tribe, which is Neytiri's tribe. And she teaches him the way of the Omatikaya. The way is a kind of spirituality, which is what I want to look at. So I have two key questions. The one is fairly simple, which is this one. Why is Avatar so popular? It's been called the most expensive film ever made and the highest grossing film ever made. However, I do want to correct something. If you take inflation into account, just the basic price of movie tickets has gone up. That's going to obviously affect how people perceive its price. It's definitely, however, still one of the most watched movies ever made. But it does have some critics. China didn't like it. They pulled it off the screens to show a film about Confucius. I thought this was quite weird, because Avatar is essentially about communism. No, it's not. But it could be. The Vatican doesn't like it because of its pagan pantheistic message, which I'll talk about. Feminists don't like it because the men are slightly more muscular than the women. Really? I don't know if that's really worth paying any attention to. And then one of the characters smokes, so anti-smoking lobbyists are very upset. And then there are some Soviet-era sci-fi fans who are very upset because it seems to have mimicked Arkadian Boris Strugatsky's Noon Universe, but accusations of plagiarism don't seem to have happened yet. So it's popular, but there are definitely critics. The second key question is, what are the ideological underpinnings of Avatar, and what are the spiritual implications of these ideological underpinnings? Just a quick note, I do want to make a point that when we interpret a film, when we try and understand the worldview of a film, it's very important not to see just what we want to see. We actually need to see what is there. Sometimes we do what is called an eisegetical reading, which is where we just are much more concerned with what we think about the film than what is really there. The opposite of that, which is the better way, and the approach I'm going to try and take here, is an exegetical reading, which tries to understand what the author wanted to say, what his creative influences were, in this case James Cameron, the director of Avatar and writer of Avatar, and then of course the narrative context will give us a sense of what's really going on in the film. So these are the things I want to look at. To begin with, the author's intention was, incidentally, to create a film that would appeal to the widest possible audience. He succeeded, in case you haven't noticed. So one of the very interesting ways to do this is to make the film just utterly visually arresting. And I think Avatar succeeds in that. It is one of the most beautiful films ever made. Especially if you see it in 3D, it sucks you in, which has some problematic dimensions to it, but it is beautiful, and that helps to make it appealing. It is syncretistic in that it draws from a lot of different religious ideas, and it draws from a lot of different creative influences in terms of the visual appeal of the film. It uses very classical mythological themes, which I'll talk about just down here. One of the most important ones is the one of the monomyth, the hero's basic rise to popularity and then taking over the world, basically. Then a great way to make a film successful is to use something which is called dialectical plotting, which is where you take very strong contrasts and place them together, because those conflicts actually drive the story forward. So those would be good versus evil, life versus death, other versus self, man or machine versus nature. So that very strong dialectical forces. On this, Robert McKee, the film guru, says this: nothing moves forward in a story except through conflict. Conflict is to storytelling what sound is to music. In other words, very, very important. You can't do away with it. If you get rid of conflict, the story just won't work. James Cameron expresses his intention in the following way: I want to make something that has action and adventure and all that. There's a lot of all that. I want to thrill you, but also to remind you that you have a conscience, that maybe enjoying the film makes you think a little bit about the way you interact with nature and with your fellow man. In various interviews, he's also expressed this idea that he wanted to comment on environmental issues and mechanized warfare. So there are definite references to Iraq and 9/11 in the film. At one point, a big tree falls down, which is very much like 9/11. And Cameron acknowledges this. And incidentally, this idea of environmental issues and mechanized warfare is something that Tolkien uses very much in Lord of the Rings. He does it much more symbolically and much more subtly, but James Cameron is not a fan of subtlety. We know this because we have all seen Titanic. He also definitely wants to make a comment on interracial interaction, so that's a very important theme, which we will look at. If you have seen Dances with Wolves or Pocahontas, Avatar does seem rather familiar, because it's the same story. He's also taken a bit from Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest, not really in terms of plot so much, but much more in terms of just the message of the film. And James Cameron also says that every science fiction book he's ever read has had some influence on how he has structured his story to create his own reality. Then there are millions, not really millions, but a lot, of spiritual or ideological influences. These are just a few. New Age spirituality, which we're all very familiar with. Pantheism or animism, which are very similar. Shamanism, which is a kind of tribal religion. Gnosticism, Hinduism, lots of Maori mythology. I'm not going to look at the Maori mythology in this film because there's just not enough time, and the words in Maori are just too long, and I couldn't remember all of them. So this is just to focus on a few of these. James Cameron came out of the 60s, and he says he's very much a fan of hippie culture, put a flower in a gun kind of stuff. And so the way he does this, though, is to put an arrow in a gun. It's a little bit more violent than hippies would have liked, and it's very steeped in romanticism. I would suggest that to a great extent, postmodernism is a new romanticism. So, and we'll look at that a bit. Lots of Christians have latched onto Avatar as a Christian movie. It's not. That was not James Cameron's intention, and it's definitely quite anti-Christian in some ways. So, what Avatar is, the word actually means, we're much more familiar with its use in computing, which is that it is a movable icon representing a person in cyberspace or virtual reality graphics. In other words, it's a self, the self, yourself, in virtual form. And what this means is that it actually is a kind of a tool that can create a new reality for yourself. You can plug yourself into cyberspace, whether through an interface or a screen or through the back of your head if you're living in the Matrix. that would create this avatar which exists in an alternate reality. This is problematic because it creates something which is hyper-real, which is a depiction that is more real than reality. If you watch Avatar, most of it, I think 80% of the film is virtual, it's digitally created. Those graphics are astounding. But in some sense, when you look at it, it is hyper-realism. It is so much more real than reality. We never see faces this, well, this big or up this close. It's not our experience of reality, and so it actually almost subverts our reality. So this actually taps very much into what Marshall McLuhan has said: the medium is the message. In this case, the three-dimensionality of the film is quite an immersive medium. It pulls you in a way that two-dimensionality doesn't. I would argue that this is the only three-dimensional film that actually works. I've seen quite a few 3D films that just, they don't really work, but somehow this does. So this leads to a semiotic condition, sorry for the long word, called hyper-reality, and this is the inability of consciousness to discern between reality and fantasy. So unreality, in a sense, replaces reality. What's very interesting is a lot of people have seen Avatar and have actually blogged about this. Bloggo World has gone nuts with this kind of stuff. Lots of people feel suicidal after having watched Avatar because it is too good. They just keep on thinking, my reality isn't this beautiful. My reality isn't this cool. And so it actually subverts Leibniz's idea that this is the best of all possible worlds. I would argue that Avatar still fits within our world. It is a smaller part of our reality that we just have to grapple with. But the more unfamiliar, perhaps, idea of an avatar is that it actually comes from a Hindu concept which has its origins in the Sanskrit, which literally means to cross down. An avatar is an embodiment or incarnation of a deity, spirit, or idea. And in Hinduism, Krishna embodies Vishnu. Vishnu is a kind of transcendent god. Krishna is his incarnation. Krishna is quite a problematic character if you actually do some reading about him. He's supposed to be quite a divine character, but he's quite mischievous and very promiscuous, so very reflective of some of the Greek gods. The other thing, I'm sure some of you must have wondered, why are the avatars blue? Because really, that's just a bit weird. And this actually also has its origins in Hinduism. They see anything blue, sky, oceans, rivers, and lakes, as good. And so blue is symbolic of courage. Don't know how they make this leap, but this is what they say. Blue is symbolic of courage, depth of character, and the capacity to defeat evil. Of course, this requires you to pronounce something as evil. In Avatar's case, this is people. People are evil. This is not good. We'll get to that. Here are some depictions of Krishna with his wife Radha, who is actually also an incarnation of a goddess. Lakshmi is her name. You can call your kid that. In fact, just a weird aside, a lot of parents have named their kids after characters in Avatar. That is just a remedy for, well, I mean, not a remedy, it's a definite cause for concern, because when those kids get to school, they're going to get mocked senseless. But there is something I really want to point out here. In Avatar, this is not a divine deity that becomes incarnate. This is a human being that becomes reincarnated. Okay, so the incarnation is actually not supernatural, in a sense, because it's you, computer interfaces allow for this to happen. So this leads to a number of ideas. Avatar affirms immanence, but not transcendence. Two examples, those seeds that little mockumentary showed are seeds of the tree of souls, and they are called very pure spirits. So the spirit is now not breath as it would be pneuma or just in in Christianity, in the Greek of the Bible, it would not be breath, something that we cannot see. It is something very tangible, very visible, and it's glowing, so it's very pretty. And at another point in the film, Grace, who is the main scientist of this group, says to one of the head honchos of this operation, which is all about finding this mineral called unobtainium. They couldn't find a better name for it, so they called it unobtainium. But she says to him, this is not some pagan mumbo-jumbo. It is, but she doesn't realize it. But something real and measurable, a biological network of energy. So she's referring to the natural environment of Pandora, and she's saying, this is not like something out there or something abstract. This is something real. Okay, so this is just another way that it affirms imminence. Avatar, in its incarnation idea, emphasizes sensual experience in the context of a hostile natural world. This is a very key idea in Romanticism and in existentialism, that of the 1960s. Again, the medium is the message. And a lot of people have argued that Avatar is a triumph of style over substance. There's not a lot of substance, although when you unpack it like this, you realize there's more than you may have initially perceived. But the style is actually much more important, because the medium itself tells you that the sensual experience is the more important aspect of the film. And at some point in the film, while Jake is learning how to be a Na'vi warrior, he says, I need to trust my body to know what to do. In other words, don't think about it too much, because your brain might explode or something. I don't think that's what it says. That's a bit of eisegetical reading. Just threw it in there for fun. Then another way that imminence is affirmed is through the idea of their goddess, who is Awa. Awa. Again, very strange word. It means yes in Arabic. That's interesting.
And it's also a mix of Yahweh.
That's interesting. Okay, as far as I know, the language, actually, most of it was taken from an Ethiopian dialect. So, it may just be a coincidence. I'm not sure. Although, the language of the Na'vi was developed by a linguist. So, whoever it was actually does understand language very well. But Awa is the goddess in nature. In nature, note this, not above and beyond nature, just in nature, and or the people. So she is very present there. And one writer says, using the power within us is the nature of the sacred feminine. Just in case you didn't know, that's what someone said. Then the voices of the ancestors are located in nature, and these are things that you can access if you are a Na'vi person. And then at some point, when Jake is trying to explain this, the flow of energy in the culture and in the environment, especially in terms of the passing from life to death or from death to life, he says, energy is only borrowed. In other words, the life force that we use to live is only borrowed and must at some point be given back. So death is a way of giving the energy back. You become non-existent, really. You die and there's nothing else. You just become part of this big network of energy. In case you were wondering if I would bring G.K. Chesterton in this, here is a quote from him. The substance of paganism may be summarized thus. It is an attempt to reach the divine reality through the imagination alone. It seeks truth by means of beauty, in the sense in which beauty includes much of the most grotesque ugliness. So we have this beautiful environment. That is the way that you capture truth. By the way, Chesterton in The Everlasting Man talks a great deal about paganism and its origins and all that. And I think if you're brave, it's a very good read. The problem is that you actually do need truth to test beauty. And James Cameron doesn't do this. Instead, he realizes that the only way to test truth for himself or for everyone else is through experience. This is where existentialism comes to the fore. So truth is sought by means of human experience as well as imagination. These two play off each other. Apologies for the length of this quote, but this is Ross Do That, or Dow That. Do That? From the New York Times, he says, pantheism has been Hollywood's religion of choice for a generation now. It is the truth that Kevin Costner discovered when he went dancing with wolves. It is the metaphysic woven through Disney cartoons like The Lion King and Pocahontas. And it's the dogma of George Lucas's Jedi, whose mystical force surrounds us, penetrates us, and binds the galaxy together. I keep on remembering when Luke Skywalker is trying to learn about the Force, and he's told to stretch out with your feelings, Luke. Stretch out with your feelings. How do you do that? But that's kind of the idea that they're going for. Hollywood keeps returning to these themes because Americans respond favorably to them. From Deepak Chopra to Eckhart Tolle, the religion and inspiration section in your local bookstore is crowded with titles pushing the pantheistic message. And this is what Leszek Kolakowski says. Pantheism sees God inside man. It brings God closer to human experience while depriving him of any recognizable traits. There are two profound paradoxes here. Pantheism leads either to a God who is very impersonal, as in Avatar, or to a God who is too personal, as in The Shack. You'll note that The Shack removes the transcendent God. God is only immanent. Devet spoke a bit about that last week. So The Shack is essentially a pagan book. But we won't talk about that now. And very interestingly, pantheism is actually a kind of atheism. And Richard Dawkins, the man himself, who is very loud and obnoxious, calls pantheism a sexed-up atheism. So it's very sexy, but it's still atheism in a different form. And with Sam Harris, who's another one of his new atheist buddies, nature is seen as a mystical space. This is the mystical space that we need to be attached to. So nature is deified, essentially. And Chesterton points this out about this kind of pantheism, which is problematic, because if God is inside man, then man is always inside himself. But if God transcends man, then man has already or is able to transcend himself. And this ties in with something that Abraham Heschel, a Jewish rabbi, teaches. The purpose of religion is to show us how to transcend ourselves. The purpose of pantheism is to show us how to glorify self. Same with atheism, same with a number of other New Agey ideas. And this lends itself to a kind of narcissism. Maybe I'm taking this to a bit of an extreme, but I think it's helpful to realize that ideas naturally do lead to other ideas. So narcissism makes God in man's image, and then it makes the other in our image. The other meaning someone who is different from ourselves, as in everyone. Okay, so it's a natural way that reality is filtered through the self only. And one of my favorite writers, Slavoj Žižek, says this: the proper way to fight the demonization of the other is to subjectivize her, to listen to her story, to understand how she perceives the situation. Or, as a partisan of the Middle East dialogue put it, an enemy is someone whose story you have not heard. Žižek is being quite ironic here, because there's a serious problem with subjectivizing the other. And this is tapped into by Annalie Newitz, who writes, Avatar is a fantasy about race told from the perspective of white people. Humans are the cause of alien oppression and distress. Then a white man, who was one of the oppressors, switches sides at the last minute, assimilating into the alien culture and becoming its savior. This film is essentially about white guilt. I bet you never thought of that before. Okay, so what happens is the subjectivization of the other results in the demonization of the self. There's a kind of extreme, I would say, overcompensation here. The other is elevated above the self, and false humility is something that does not see reality as it is. A fairly good practical example of this is I went recently with a bunch of friends to see a comedy show at the State Theatre. And of the five comedians, two were white. And what they did, both of them, I was just alarmed at this, both of them spent their entire gig, their 20-minute section, talking about how it is better to be black than white. Now, racism, as we know, is a huge problem, but I think what it does, what is bad, is that in order to kill the racism, what inevitably happens is you tip it over to the other side and create a new form of racism. So what Cameron has here in Avatar is exactly that. It's a kind of reverse racism. It's also very interesting. I'm going to just mention this. Two fundamentalisms against each other, which are both wrong. But I'll mention more about that later. If we seek to create hyperreality in our own image, we end up with a reality that exists only as long as we do and ends when we die. So pantheism / atheism leads to narcissism, which is inherently nihilistic. Am I saying Avatar is a nihilistic film? Yes, I am. Before us, there is nothing. After us, there is nothing. And in between, we go shopping. In between is the meaninglessness that we create, or the meaning that we create. And I would say that meaning created out of nothing, ex nihilo, can only ever be nihilism. My definition of nihilism is that it is the illusion of meaning. It taps into a Hindu concept called Maya, everything is illusion. Very interesting stuff. Okay, now that was the bashing Avatar thing. Now I'm going to try and put it into a bit of perspective. And it is a Christian's perspective, in other words, mine. I may be wrong, and you can definitely have your own opinion about this. I would suggest that Avatar's vision is not wrong, but horribly incomplete. And I find this with a lot of worldviews. It is not necessarily that they're on the wrong track. It's just that their track is too small. A good example of this is in Acts 17, where Paul goes to this the Areopagus village, and he notices that they have lots of statues of lots of gods, and then they have the statue to the unknown god. They have to make sure that they've covered all the gods. And he comes in and he goes, it's maybe not necessarily a good idea to just bash all their idols. They are idols. He needs a way to transcend that, because their vision is very small. And so he says, I know who your unknown God is. And then he explains how that works. If we ask questions about Avatar, we have to ask, is the material realm all there is? Even if you are an atheist, it would probably be a good idea to say, well, I can't be absolutely sure of that. What is goodness apart from the sensual experience of nature? In other words, Is goodness just a sensate experience? I certainly hope not, because then there is no place for morality anywhere. There is just live and let live, or live and let die if you're James Bond. So how should we view nature if this is incomplete? So just to supplement this, Christianity is not the antithesis of paganism, but a context or corrective for it. Paganism teaches us to serve nature, or the self's created version of nature, and so nature becomes an idol. Christianity teaches us to love the one who made nature, and thus to love the nature that he made. Puts everything into context. So I just have four points to finish off with. The first one is that an impersonal spirituality is very easy to control and manipulate to suit ourselves. But if we really think about it, morality is always personal. Goodness, truth, and beauty are personal. Reality is personal. These are not abstract, impersonal ideas. They are things that even experientially we know. So to deny that is a huge problem. This is quite a tough one, but I wanted to put it in because I think it really does explain a lot. John Milbank, who's one of my favorite theologians, writes this: paganism is confined to certain tropes which always operate in the same way and whose mode of comparison is subject to fully logical grasp, especially reduced metonymy and synecdoche, thereby insinuating a possible manipulation of the human and the divine by faith. Only monotheism allows an openly metaphorical invocation of God, which truly retains the mysterious paradoxical tension of both and so invites endlessly further exploration, and does not permit degeneration into the idea of the capture of the divine by univocal technique, which often translates into a calculus of blood. How was that? Okay, I'm going to just latch onto the first idea is simply that in creating a language that reduces things, it doesn't allow the language to actually escape itself. Semiotically, there's just a circle of meaning which is confined within its own space. This is what deconstructionists refer to as language creating reality. It's kind of like, in quantum physics, it's kind of like Schrodinger's cat, that whole idea. But what John Milbank says in the second part is essentially what happens in monotheism, essentially, and especially Christianity, is that we use metaphorical language. Language is always pointing to the beyond. It's always pointing beyond itself. We cannot define God, but we can say what God is like. And that's, I'm just, even humanly speaking, I cannot define any person. I can only point to them. So truth is something we point to, it's not something we own. And that's, pantheism owns the truth, we don't. And just towards the end, he talks about how this controlling this reality through language ends up as a calculus of blood. Only a British person could write that. It's just beautiful. The idea is essentially that there will only ever be violence. When you can control God, when you can make God in your own image, you will be a fundamentalist and you will be violent. And that's, in Avatar, both sides are violent. That's just the natural default state of a fundamentalist mindset. The second idea I want to touch on is that nature is just not heaven, it's not utopia, and it's silly to idolize it as such. Even in Avatar, there is this idea that nature is red in tooth and claw. There is a lot of violence and tension and bloodshed. And without a context for that, there is no good and evil. There's just what you need to do. That's a viper wolf. It's very pretty, don't you think? The third thing is that Earth is not our mother, but our sister. God is our father, the church is our mother, if you want to use a metaphor. And this is something St. Francis of Assisi said: in order not to elevate nature above God's natural order, man is supposed to look after nature, not be dominated by it. Then the last thing is that nature is a lens to look through, not at. It's very easy in our culture. We are so obsessed with the peripheral stuff. It becomes the stuff we look at. We are obsessed with nature, and so we have ecological movements which are, I would dare say, take it a little too far. It's like, who cares about the AIDS crisis in the world? Those are people who are suffering. Let's elevate ecology to a higher level, because this is something we can control. But I do want to point out that this is difficult, because most of what we experience and see is a kind of opaque lens. So we look through an opaque lens at an invisible God. This is a very tricky idea, but I think it's fundamental to understanding that there are mysteries we just can't understand. We can't control certain things, and we rely a great deal on God's input. This kind of reflects in 1 Corinthians 13 the idea that we look through a glass darkly. And poets have definitely latched onto this idea that nature is a lens. In the Psalms, we read that the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. And then also, the earth is full of the steadfast love of the Lord. And more recent psalmist, Gerard Manley Hopkins, writes this, the earth is charged with the grandeur of God. And I think that is a way of seeing the good, even in paganism. Thanks.